Hello and welcome to the Anonymous Anthropologist Podcast with your host, the Anonymous Anthropologist. That's me. I am a community college professor of anthropology with more than 10 years of teaching in the classroom and a master's degree from Columbia University. I'd happily tell you more about me if only I could be sure that it wouldn't get me fired. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. I am the Anonymous Anthropologist, here with you today to talk about Darwin and evolution. Evolution is something that a lot of people still dismiss as just a theory. In the first podcast, we talked about that and explained that a theory is essentially a fact, that a theory is something you arrive at after experimentation, observation, data collection. And when all of this information comes in and demonstrates that your hypothesis is correct, then you arrive at a theory, which is a summary statement of the facts. So simply put, a theory is a fact. One cannot reject the idea of the theory without rejecting the idea of science. And one cannot reject the idea of evolution without rejecting the idea of science. As I've said on my blog a couple of times, I find it hypocritical that the same people who dismiss the science behind evolution rely on science when they get sick to cure them. So evolution is not something that can be dismissed as just a theory. Evolution is, as far as we know, the fact of how the world works from a biological point of view. A lot of people think that when Charles Darwin came out with his theories, that they were shocking, that people rejected them out of hand, and that's not at all what happened. When Darwin published his book On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection in 1859, it sold out immediately. Its theories were not only accepted immediately by pretty much everyone in science, but they had been stated before in a variety of forms by many, many other scientists. His book was merely a culmination of observations made not just by him, but by everyone at the time. If Darwin hadn't come up with the theory, surely someone else would have. In fact, students of the science know that Darwin did have competition. A.R. Wallace, someone he knew, someone he had corresponded with. Wallace was about to come out with his own paper on the theory of evolution when Darwin rushed to publication. Evolution was not a surprise to anyone. Human beings have known about and understood evolution from the moment we began domesticating plants and animals, because evolution is merely a process of change. In our world, we human beings change everything that we come in contact with. Every plant, every animal that we have domesticated bears no resemblance to its wild original forebears. Let's look at corn. Corn is a New World crop. Corn was unknown in Europe and Africa until after the so-called discovery of the New World. Corn had been harvested in North and South America for thousands of years before the Europeans ever saw it. The ancient ancestor of corn was a tiny little cob about the size of your thumb, known as teosinte. And teosinte was basically a mouthful, if you were lucky. Our ancient ancestors in the New World gathered this plant in wild stands. They chose the best cobs, the most succulent kernels. They harvested them and brought them back to wherever it was they were settled at the time. There, they ate what they could and discarded the rest, in the manner that most human beings have done for the millennia, which is to say, they tossed it over their shoulders. And of course, eventually, the teosinte started growing right there in their own backyard, so to speak. We're pretty smart. We put two and two together and we realized that if we put the corn kernels in the dirt ourselves, where it was convenient for us, that we could grow the plant. Instead of having to seek it out and search for it, we could grow it nearby and have it convenient. Well, when the first crop comes in, you go through it and you collect the best cobs, the best kernels, the best food. You eat what you can and you plant the rest. When the second crop comes in, you go through the process again and you weed out only the best. And those are the ones that you reserve for planting the following year. And so year by year, generation by generation, that teosinte gets bigger and juicier until eventually you get something close to the ear of corn with which we're familiar today. Of course, our corn has been modified by genetic tinkering as well, so it's uber corn when compared to the ancient teosinte. Corn is just one example. Any food that you can buy in the supermarket bears very little resemblance to its ancient ancestor. Look at wheat. A lot of people are discovering that they have sensitivities to wheat or gluten. Well, why is this? If we adapt and evolve, then why haven't we adapted to eat wheat? And the short answer is because we haven't been eating it for very long, especially in the form in which we consume it. The wheat that we eat today bears very little resemblance to the ancient ancestral grains. Also, The wheat we use today goes through a much more significant processing. So we haven't been eating it for very long, and our systems actually haven't had very much time to adjust to it. We probably did not evolve to eat it in its present state. Again, you could say that about a lot of food that we consume. Apples are another example. As Michael Pollan explained in his wonderful book, The Botany of Desire, the original apples were largely pretty flavorless. They would plant seeds all across the country and have contests to see who could actually grow a tree with an apple worth eating. And so we came up with all these dozens of different varieties of apples, named in some cases for the people who found them growing on their property, like Granny Smith or Mr. McIntosh. In one case, I suppose they said, hey, that's a really delicious apple, and so now we have delicious apples. However, the great majority of apples were what was known as spitters, which means they weren't really worth eating. Why were Americans fond of them anyway? Well, they made a darn good cider, and eventually a darn good liquor as well. The apples we have today are all cloned. They're cloned from the one tree way back when that produced an apple worth eating. Every McIntosh apple is a clone of the original McIntosh tree. Every Red Delicious apple comes from a clone of the original Red Delicious tree. And again, these apples have been modified over time through selective practices of farming, so they bear very little resemblance to their ancient ancestors. The same, of course, is true of animals. If we took any of our domesticated animals now and set them loose on the land to take care of themselves, forget it. They rely on us entirely to feed them, and in a lot of cases, for their reproduction. Barbara Kingsolver, in her book, Animal Vegetable Miracle, talked about raising turkeys and the fact that no one she knew could explain how they reproduced because commercial turkey farmers do not allow their birds to get old enough to reach an age of reproduction. So no one could really tell her how to do it. I have a neighbor who raises corgis. These dogs do not know how to have sex. It's true. His male, when one of the females went into heat, would mount her head. I know, sounds like something a human would do, but clearly not reproductive. In order for these dogs to reproduce, my neighbor inseminates them by hand. And yet I love him. Horses. I'm not sure that very many racehorses are allowed to actually reproduce by mounting a mare anymore because the horses are so delicate they can injure themselves or the female. No, there is some human being who gets paid to, well, shall we say, extract sperm from the male horse, and another human being who gets paid to, well, implant it in the female. Fun job. My point here is that human beings have been modifying plants and animals for as long as we have been human. The animals and plants with which we are familiar today often bear very little resemblance to their original ancestors. In fact, the very definition of a domesticated plant or an animal is that it relies upon human beings for its survival and reproduction. Look at cats. The domestic house cat is a wonderful hunter. The average cat can kill hundreds of birds without any problem at all. In fact, it is a problem for the birds, but not so much for the cat. But does the cat actually eat the bird? Of course not. The cat drops that bird on your doorstep as a little gift. Here it is, Mommy. Look at what I did. Look at what I brought you. Where's my dinner? The same thing with dogs. The average dog, if set loose on the street, would resort to digging through trash cans for food, not hunting. Occasionally, dogs do gather in packs to hunt, but left to their own devices, they're relatively helpless in that regard. I once knew a German shepherd who brought pigeons home to his owner on a daily basis. Never ate them, of course. He much preferred the hamburger that his owner prepared for him. The process of domesticating these plants and animals is something human beings have known about for a very long time. It's called breeding, or artificial selection. What we do is we select the traits that we prefer, and we allow only those organisms to reproduce. So if we look at dogs, for example, we know that dogs are descended from the wolf. How did this happen? Well, there are a lot of good books and films out there, but I'll sum it up very briefly. Wolves have probably always been attracted to human campsites because of the organic waste available to them. Those wolves, who were a little less frightened of humans, had a big advantage. Because when the humans approached the garbage heap, the ones who were frightened would run away, and the ones who weren't would stay, and they would thus be better fed and more attractive to mates. They would then have a sort of reproductive advantage. They would live longer lives, they would be better fed, they would attract more mates, have more pups. So the first thing that happens is the wolves sort of self-select, and the ones who have more tolerance for human beings get advantages from hanging around the campsite where they can consume the organic waste. Eventually, the human beings start choosing to breed these wolves, or these pre-dogs, as they might have been. Now, how do human beings control animal breeding? Well, simple. We sterilize or kill those we don't want to reproduce. So let's say this ancient human is looking at these very friendly wolves that have been hanging around the campsite for generations, and they're very accustomed to human beings, and they decide, I really like these medium-sized ones, and I'm just going to let them breed, and they sterilize or kill the others. So the next generation, they have all these medium-sized proto-dogs. And they say, well, I really like the white ones. I'm just going to let the white ones reproduce. And then a generation later, they say, oh, I like the ones with the long, straight tails. And they only let them reproduce. And then eventually they select for white dogs with black spots. Before you know it, you have Dalmatians. And this is how we have arrived at every single dog breed, is through the selective breeding for specific traits. This is called artificial selection. Well, this is what evolution is. Evolution is a process of change to the species. It's a process whereby one species changes into another, or the form of the species itself changes. All Darwin did was explain how evolution works in the absence of human tinkering. And since humans aren't doing the tinkering, we're not artificially selecting anything. What's doing the tinkering? Well, nature is doing the tinkering. Nature is doing the selecting. Therefore, Darwin's theory was called a theory of natural selection. And here's a little secret. We're talking about 1859. In 1859, the word nature was fairly synonymous with the word God. Yeah, there were a lot of scientists who were also people of faith, and they saw this selection as being made by God. Well, you can call it natural selection. Maybe it's God doing the selecting. So again, the theory, not so blasphemous or heretical as some might imagine. Now, Darwin was not the first to attempt to explain how evolution happens in the absence of human tinkering. There were lots of people who'd given it a shot previously. In anthropology classes, we have a few dead white guys we like to talk about. Forgive the expression, but I can't help but thinking of it that way. Dead white guys because, well, they're the ones who made it into the books because they had lots of power, prestige, money, opportunity, even though, as I had said earlier, a lot of people were thinking these ideas at the same time. One thing we have to understand is that in the 19th century, it was not really okay to think about evolution, at least from the point of view of the church. The church was very heavily invested in a biblical creationist landscape. So to consider evolution as even a possibility was for centuries heretical. Now, according to the church, evolution was not possible, and either was extinction. The reason is obvious. It's because God created everything, and God is perfect. And since God is perfect, all creation is perfect, therefore it would never change or go extinct. This is an idea known as fixity. Fixity of species. Species once created never evolve, never go extinct, because they are created by a perfect creator. That's a point of view that leaves no room for science. But eventually, science happened anyway. One of the first people to come forward and claim that extinction did in fact happen was a man by the name of Georges Cuvier. Cuvier said, once in a while, a natural disaster occurs and a species is wiped out. He called this catastrophism. A great catastrophe will wipe out a species. Well, that was definitely a step forward in thinking, because prior to Cuvier, scientists were generally not willing to come forward and talk about the possibility of extinction. It was a good idea, but it was still pretty God-focused. If you think about it, what's a natural disaster? What's a catastrophe? Well, it's an act of God. The next step was taken by Lamarck, J.B. Lamarck. Well, Lamarck actually has a much longer name. It's Jean-Baptiste Pierre-Antoine de Monet Chevalier de Lamarck. I love saying that. I took all that French in high school. Let's make it worthwhile. Lamarck was one of the first people to come forward with what at the time seemed like a reasonable explanation for evolution, how evolution occurred. And just the fact that he was willing to say evolution happened was a step forward. So Lamarck had a couple of ideas which were a little confused, to say the least. Firstly, he had this idea that individual organisms could change during the course of their lifetime and then pass those changes on to their descendants. So in the textbooks, you see the picture of the giraffes. The giraffes are stretching their necks so they can reach leaves ever higher on the trees. See, Lamarck thought that the first giraffes had short necks like other mammals. But because they eat leaves on trees, they had to stretch. They had to stretch their necks up to reach the higher leaves. And so they stretched their necks, and then their babies had long necks. Well, I know to us that sounds patently ridiculous, but it made sense to him because he was simply thinking about the fact that when you use a muscle, it gets bigger. So, for example, you can weightlift and get big biceps, but you know as well as I do that your baby will not then be born with large biceps. That's called the inheritance of acquired characteristics, sometimes known as soft inheritance. And nowadays we know that that's ridiculous. If you work out at the gym, you are not necessarily going to have buff babies. You cannot pass on traits you acquire in life to your offspring unless those traits do something to change your DNA, because your offspring inherits your DNA, not your big muscles. They inherit the potential, perhaps, for big muscles. So Lamarck was actually pretty wrong about the mechanism of evolution, and it took Darwin to spell it out in simple terms. Charles Darwin, for his time and place and station in life, there were big expectations. His father expected him to become a doctor, but he didn't do very well in school. He was much more interested in laying on his belly in the grass and looking at the insects and the blades of grass. So his father sent him to seminary, where he was studying to become a parson, sort of a minister. He was, indeed, a religious man. And in his day, lots of people thought about evolution as divine action. It was something that God made happen. Now, Darwin had the luck to wind up on a ship called the Beagle, which made a voyage to South America and the Galapagos Islands. Darwin was not a sailor. He was an Englishman accustomed to landlubbing. He was seasick the whole time. In his cabin on the ship, he slept on a hammock that was barely long enough to accommodate his fully stretched out body, and the hammock swayed back and forth with every movement of the ship. Darwin found himself continually seasick. The story is told that the ship's captain would drop him off at one end of an island so he could walk it, studying it, and then meet him at the other end. But I imagine that Darwin was simply thrilled at the prospect of getting off the ship. During his time on the Galapagos Islands and throughout the voyage, Darwin took copious notes. He returned to England, where he discussed them with friends, but waited 23 years before he published the book that would go on to change science on the origin of species by means of natural selection. Most people think that Darwin waited so long because he was afraid of ridicule, because he thought that no one would accept his theories as legitimate, because he was afraid of the ire of the church. In fact, he resisted publishing because of his faith and that of his wife, Emma. All his life, Darwin suffered from physical problems. On the Beagle, he was perpetually seasick. Before he was even married, he suffered from heart palpitations, stomach problems, and headaches. To quote Wikipedia, for the rest of his life, he was repeatedly incapacitated, with episodes of stomach pains, vomiting, severe boils, palpitations, trembling, and other symptoms, particularly during times of stress, such as attending meetings or making social visits. The cause of Darwin's illness remained unknown. Yet she married him. Emma was Charles's first cousin. She knew what she was getting, but she married him. I guess that's love. At any rate, Emma was a woman of faith, and when she heard about Charles's theories, she truly feared for his immortal soul. More importantly, she worried that they would not be able to spend eternity in paradise together if he were to publish his work. When it finally became clear that other men would get credit if he didn't go ahead and publish, Emma actually supported him in his writing and helped him to edit it in a way that would be least offensive to God and the church. The book was an immediate critical success, at least in the scientific community. And what it explained was how evolution happens in nature, the process of natural selection. Natural selection is very simple to understand. There are a few factors at work here. Here's what Darwin said. As many more individuals of each species are born than can possibly survive, and as, consequently, there is a frequently recurring struggle for existence, it follows that any being, if it vary however slightly in any manner profitable to itself, under the complex and sometimes varying conditions of life, will have a better chance of surviving and thus be naturally selected. From the strong principle of inheritance, any selected variety will tend to propagate its new and modified form. Translation. Some individuals have certain advantages which allow them to survive and reproduce. Others are not so lucky. They may survive but fail to reproduce, or they may not survive at all. Only those individuals who survive to reproduce will pass on their genes in a way that contributes to the evolution of the species. In other words, it's all about reproduction. Darwin's explanation is often incorrectly glossed as survival of the fittest, and I have to admit that if you read that statement that I just read to you, it does appear to say that. It does appear to indicate that there is a struggle for existence and that only some survive. But Darwin does go on to state that what is important is not that that individual survives, but that that individual goes on to reproduce and pass on its traits. So here's how it works. In any environment, there's a population of animals. A population is a group of animals who will mate within the group. And all of those animals are of the same species because, of course, they can mate with each other and successfully produce offspring who themselves can have offspring. They are members of the same biological species. Some of those individuals will have genetic variations, which will make them more able to succeed in their particular environment. If the environment changes, only certain individuals will have genetic traits that allow them to survive and succeed in that change. Therefore, nature selects individuals to succeed in any particular environment based on their genetic characteristics, and genetics are pretty much luck of the draw. Those individuals with characteristics that allow them to survive and reproduce will succeed in passing on their traits until eventually the whole of the population looks like that. That's evolution. It's a change in the species. The key component here is reproduction. You can live to be as old as Methuselah, but if you have no children, evolution doesn't give a damn about you. You have not contributed to the species. You can live to be 17 and have 100 children, and boy, you have been evolutionarily successful. By the biological standard, the man who contributes his sperm to a sperm bank and fathers dozens, if not hundreds, of children he never knows is incredibly evolutionarily successful. That's why it's so important to screen sperm donors to make sure that they are not passing on congenital problems. Proportionally, they have many, many more children than men who actually have sex to reproduce. The key to evolution is reproduction, not survival. That's why I am so sick of hearing people explain evolution as survival of the fittest. You hear it from anthropologists and archaeologists all the time on the History Channel and the Discovery Channel and National Geographic and in all of those commercial media. But you hear it from professionals. You hear that all the time, survival of the fittest. That's what evolution is. And that is not what evolution is, because the emphasis is in the wrong place. Survival of the fittest is really a social construct that has a lot to do with industrialism and capitalism and, to a large extent, social Darwinism. Social Darwinism is really, really different from Darwin's theory of natural selection, and that's something that we'll save for a later podcast. For the moment, let's stick with biology. When I think of survival of the fittest, my mind goes immediately to sea turtles. Sea turtles. I think perhaps I'll post a link to a YouTube video on the Anonymous Anthropologist website for you to look at with this podcast. When you think of survival of the fittest, we think of it in human terms. We think of it as head-to-head competition in terms of intellect and achievement. When you think of it in animal terms, you think of elks clashing their racks against each other, competing it out for the access to the females. It's all very romantic and Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom from my childhood. That's what immediately comes to mind. But it's not always quite that exciting or quite that competitive. So my mind turns to the sea turtles. Sea turtles live their entire lives at sea, and the females swim ashore by the thousands and dig nests laying anywhere from, 50 to a couple of hundred eggs. And it takes about 2 months for these eggs to incubate, and all of the hatchlings tend to hatch together and around the same time. And if they're lucky enough to hatch at night, then a good proportion of them succeed in making it back to the water. But if they're unfortunate enough to hatch during the day, the predators are waiting, and it's a really unfortunate sight. The little tiny babies are just coming out of their shells and standing there. Right above them are these giant seagulls, and gulp them down in one swallow. And I have to ask myself, is that survival of the fittest? Is there something about those brand new hatchlings that makes them somehow less fit to succeed in this life? No, of course not. That's just a matter of luck. It's a matter of luck and timing, and there's nothing about that hatchling that made it less fit to survive. And so it's not about competition. It's not about head-to-head competition. A good lot of this is luck, either genetic luck, luck of the environment, luck of timing, and you can't take credit for luck. So survival of the fittest is incorrect in its entirety, because it's not survival that matters, it's reproduction. And fitness is more about luck than any personal characteristics that an individual might possess. If I could accomplish one thing, really, with this podcast, it would be to have professionals stop using the phrase, because it just confuses things and it reinforces the misinterpretation. And I think I will discuss that in another podcast. It really is about social Darwinism. So to sum up for now, Darwin did not have really a theory of evolution, because evolution was well understood as a process when it came to artificial selection. Darwin merely explained how selection happens in the natural environment without the intervention of people. For millennia, human beings had been artificially selecting plants and animals. Darwin showed us how nature does the selecting. Darwin's theory, then, is a theory of natural selection, not precisely a theory of evolution. The theory of natural selection was not shocking to anyone at the time. It was fully understood how human beings could cause change within an animal species through selective breeding. Darwin's theories merely pointed out that in nature, certain individuals have differences that make them more or less successful in their given environment. Those individuals with differences that give them advantages for reproduction in the environment will succeed in passing on those advantages. Those individuals with differences that give them disadvantages for surviving and reproducing in that environment will fail to pass on those traits. As this process continues through the generations, eventually the form of the species may change. If it changes enough so that the new version is not capable of reproducing hypothetically with the old version, well, then you have a new species. There is nothing shocking or heretical about any of this. It's just a case of good old-fashioned sex and reproduction. It's readily observable, empirical fact that's out there in the world for us to see. It is not a head-to-head struggle for survival, necessarily, and it's not even necessarily a struggle between males for mating. It's simply a matter of who has the luck to reproduce and pass on their genes to the next generation. It is the case that Darwin did eventually make a connection between human beings and some sort of primate ancestor, but we'll save that for another podcast. Well, that's it. That's all I've got for today. Hope you enjoyed the podcast. I hope you'll think about giving me a call, leaving me a message, or sending me an email. I'd love to be able to communicate with the listeners. Right now, it's just me alone in a room with a microphone, but I'm hoping that we can turn this into more of a conversation, a debate, in fact. That would be a lot of fun. So if you think I've said something incorrect, I'll allow for that. I think it's possible that you might have information that I don't. It's possible that your perspective is different enough from mine to allow me some enlightenment, and I would love to engage with you. So give me a call whether you agree or disagree. You can leave me a message at 206-312-3526. That's 206-312-3526. Or you can send me an email to theanonymousanthropologist@gmail.com. You can check out the website, the blog, at www.theanonymousanthropologist.com. You can find the podcast there, or you can also find the podcast on iTunes. I do have a Facebook page, The Anonymous Anthropologist, and would certainly be grateful if you would go ahead and like me. I think the last time I checked, I had 7 likes, which is okay. Try not to let that hurt my ego too much. But apparently, we've got over 70 podcast listeners. So if you would go ahead and like me on Facebook, I would be able to get some stats. That would be very helpful for figuring out what direction to go next. I will continue blogging at theanonymousanthropologist.com. You can also find me on Twitter at @anonymousanthro. For now, I'll say farewell. See you in about 10 days. Till then, take care.
Am I recording?